Mike? 906.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Growing up isn't easy for the child or the parent. It isn't a smooth line on a graph. It is a road full of bumps and detours. Many say the teen years are the worst as children dip their toes into the pool of adulthood, but the tween years can be equally difficult, if not more so. The tween years begin in middle school. It's a time when children's brains and bodies are undergoing a change that makes life bewildering for them and their parents. However, none of this is foreign to Michelle Eichert. She has been working with children this age for years and has a few of her own. 10 years ago, she created the social leadership curriculum Athena's Path for girls and Hero's Pursuit for boys. She's been on this program to talk about that. That program is now used in schools across the country. She also started the website MichelleInTheMiddle.com as a resource for parents and educators of kids in or headed to middle school. And she's written a book about guiding children through these turbulent years. It's called Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. Michelle Eichert joins us for the hour. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you again. In your bio, you say that you grew up outside Boston and attended middle school in Cambridge, where you were decidedly awkward and insecure. Is that where your interest in this period of life began? Or is that why it began? Or are there other factors in this?
Well, there are other factors, but truly my middle school experience did inspire the work that I do. About 10 years ago, I had my own tutoring business, and I was working with kids in middle school who were telling me their stories about what was happening in all the transitional spaces of school. So that's the hallways, the buses, the cafeterias, places where teachers really aren't watching you as closely. And listening to those stories, I was thrown right back to my awkward middle school years, and I wanted to do something to help.
You know, I don't recall having awkward middle school years, and I'm not sure why that is. We went to junior high.
Right.
And that's a difference. Does that make a difference?
There is a difference. There was a big
switch.
Because
it was 8th and 9th.
Right, 8th and 9th, and it depends on what part of the country you're in.
Actually, it was 7th and 8th, excuse me, because high school began in 9th grade. But 7th and 8th was junior high.
And I think here in Charlotte, it was 7, 8, 9 were clustered together. Where I was, it was just 7th and 8th. So depending upon where you grew up, you probably had a slightly different experience. Most people I know tell me they wouldn't go back to middle school for $1 million. I mean, it is such a raw time of life that a lot of people are still kind of healing from that. I'm always happy when people tell me, like you, that they didn't have a bad middle school experience or that they had a really good middle school experience. And sometimes people are afraid to tell me that, but I do. Oh. I am happy about that.
Well, we had nuns, so I don't think we were allowed to have a bad experience.
Right.
If you catch my drift.
Right.
Anyway, you started working with kids this age a decade ago, first tutoring, then with Athena's Path and Hero's Pursuit, which we've talked about on this program in the past. But now you have a 7th and a 9th grader in the family.
I do.
Is the experience of working with other children and hearing their stories substantially different from dealing with people in your own family where you have to take a different approach, one would imagine?
I think it's always the case that when something is really close to you, it changes. You bring all of your own memories and biases and concerns and hopes to the situation. So with my kids, of course, things can get a little bit more entangled. When I'm looking at another family or helping a kid in one of my programs, the solution becomes clear really quickly. But with my own kids, it's always a little bit more entangled. I will say they have both had really great experiences in middle school. My son's still there. He's 7th grade. My daughter just started in high school, and she loved middle school.
How do you explain that?
Well, I hope it had something.
Is it because of you?
I hope it had something to do with sort of my training over the past 10 years. My approach toward middle school, and the one that I'm projecting in the book, is that parents should embrace it. They should be excited about the changes instead of clamping down, instead of being full of fear and dread, to look at this time of life as one of opportunity. And so that's what we've tried to do in our house.
Hmm. And when you read this book, you come across what you're telling parents to do and how they should react and how they should act around their children is almost like a psychologist. They become a psychologist during this period of life.
And I am trying to be really careful myself so that people know that I'm not a psychologist. I've read a lot of books on psychology. I am a expert on middle schoolers and their social world through experience. Mm-hmm. But yes, I do think that parents should take a more thoughtful approach to how they react to their kids rather than just an emotional one.
What makes this period of life for kids so awkward, embarrassing, fraught with dilemmas? What is it about that period of life?
This time of life is really the perfect storm. We have a lot of things happening at the same time that can make it feel pretty chaotic. And I call the middle school years the middle school construction project because there are three things that every kid needs to build in order to become an adult. They need to begin building an adult body, an adult brain, and an adult identity. And all of those things happen at around age 11 when kids are going into middle school. So you've
But that's so far away from adulthood.
It is, but it's a long process.
Okay.
So that lasts over 7 years, maybe longer. In fact, a boy's brain isn't really fully developed until age 24. For girls, it's age 21, 22. So there's a little bit of a gap there in developmental time. But that puts the half-life of development right around middle school.
Right. Wow. This is a stage of life where kids who may have been closely connected to their families and to their parents begin to purposefully distance themselves. Do they know that they're distancing themselves, or are they just feeling their oats and feeling braver about the world around them?
I think that's it. I don't think a kid wakes up, at least from my own memory, and watching my kids go through this, I don't think a kid wakes up and says, today is the day I start spending less time with my mom. But I do think it's a very purposeful and natural thing. So what happens is that around age 11, and again, all the way up through high school, kids have to develop an identity apart from their parents to become a whole adult. So that looks like spending more time with peers and spending more time in your room. And parents begin to feel really sad and confused and sometimes betrayed by this. But truly, it's what needs to happen for kids to become really balanced adults.
And you point out that, you know, it's a time when kids are a contradiction because in one moment they want to cuddle up with mom or dad on the sofa. Maybe a little girl still wants to play with her dolls,
right,
but not in front of other little girls her age. Little boys may want their mom to hold them and maybe kiss them on the forehead, but not in front of the guys. And so they still want to be a little kid, but they don't want to be a little kid.
Right. And identity development is not a linear process. So just like you said in the intro, it's sort of a roller coaster ride. And so mm-hmm. it's sometimes they want to be with you and they want to be your sweet baby. And then the next second, you see your daughter sneaking on some makeup before she heads off to school. So there's a lot of kind of jogging back and forth between adult and little kid.
When a girl does that,
yeah,
when she's sneaking on makeup, is she doing that to thwart you as the mom or the dad?
No.
Or is she doing that to say, I'm trying this on. I'm trying adulthood on for size here.
Yes. So consider the middle school construction project. And when I talk to middle schoolers, and this is sort of known throughout the industry, when you talk to middle schoolers about what their worst fear is, the word that they use most often is not being normal. Then you think about the fact that they're building an adult brain, an adult body, an adult identity, and they have to go through those transitional spaces of school. So imagine a girl walking down the hallway in middle school, and she's being evaluated by her peers thousands of times a day on her construction project. Is she developing too quickly? Is she wearing makeup yet? Is she a spaz? Is she still a little baby? And so all day long, she's being judged by her peers. Mm-hmm. And she's trying things on to see, what will help me be accepted by this tribe? She feels that pull away from the family. She knows she has to start becoming more independent, but everybody wants to have a tribe. So she's thinking, what are things I can do while I'm going through all of this new activity and new development that will help people take me in?
Is it harder for girls? Because they are developing physically differently than boys. Boys get muscular and chiseled and things like that, but that happens later, actually. Is
right.
it more difficult for?
I wouldn't say that it's more difficult. I don't think it's fair to say that it's harder for one or the other. I think they each face really unique challenges. And because of the time frame of how girls and boys develop, mm-hmm. it happens earlier for girls. So I think it may be harder in the sense that it's sooner, But I think both boys and girls go through different
things. Are girls tougher on other girls than boys are on other boys?
That I will agree with. I do think there's something called relational aggression. So just as girls are looking for their tribe and looking for where to fit in around the middle school years, the way that boys bully each other traditionally, historically, has been physical. So if you had a problem with someone or you wanted to assert your own dominance, you would hit someone.
Right.
Girls hit each other where it hurts most, which is their relationships with each other. So relational aggression is damaging another girl's relationship among her peers so that she is less and you are more. And that's gossip and humiliation and all of that.
And when guys get hit or bullied or and girls go through what you just talked about, when they go home in their private time, do they handle it differently or is it the same for the two? I mean, is it as emotional for a guy to go through that with other guys as opposed to girls who really can be – I mean, they can be brutal and just tear that other little girl down to shreds. There's nothing left of her.
Right.
Do they handle it differently? Does it impact them differently?
I don't think that the impact is any less for a boy or a girl, but I think they absolutely handle it differently. Mm-hmm. So we see boys who tend to lock it up. Sometimes they get angry. Sometimes they get sad. Sometimes they feel weak. But they're very reluctant to talk about it. And it's the question I get asked most by moms of boys is, how do I get my boy to talk to me? Because I know things are going on at school. He's changed. Something's different. He's withdrawn. And to a certain extent, some of that is just normal. But boys do tend to lock it up, and that can be dangerous.
Well, boys don't talk because men don't talk. That's why sports exists, to give guys something to talk about.
You know, there is some truth in that. And I encourage parents of middle school boys that even if their son isn't a jock, he's not fitting in because he's not playing sports, to at least give them the language of sports because it helps you relate to other people.
So if men don't talk in general, and that's what we hear from women all the time, they just don't talk.
I think there's a study that says they use less words
a day. That's right. We do. We use fewer words a day unless you do a talk show.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get a boy to talk, either to mom or dad, particularly when they're bottling things up, like you say?
Yep. A couple tips. One thing that I find helps with boys is to get them active. My son talks to me more if we're on a bike ride than if we're sitting down at the table together making eye contact. Making eye contact really is a bad thing to do with boys. And I sometimes joke it's like prison rules when you're talking to a middle schooler. You don't make eye contact. You don't say too much.
It's like talking to a dog.
You want them in the back seat of the car while you're driving around.
Is eye contact threatening to them? Is that what it
is? Yeah. I mean, it just shuts them down. It's too much. And I think kids feel vulnerable because of all of these changes and because of all this judgment.
Is that true of girls? Don't look them in the eye?
Yeah, it helps not to look in the eye. It really does. It seems bizarre.
But you grow up hearing mom and dad say, when you meet somebody, give them a firm handshake and look them in the eye.
And I agree with that. There's a time and a place. I think manners are really important and underrated, and we should be teaching kids manners.
Okay.
So you do a proper introduction, you look somebody in the eye. But when you want to find out something that's making someone feel vulnerable, give them a little bit of space. They can be in the back seat of the car while you're driving around. Middle schoolers aren't really sitting in the back seat at this age. Younger kids are. You could be on a bike ride. They could be chopping vegetables next to you in the kitchen. You could be playing a video game. That works really well for boys. As long as the heat is off, they're more likely to talk. The other thing that works well for boys is scheduling a time to talk because they don't like to be ambushed. So a lot of moms will be waiting in the car or in the door and the kid gets off the bus and they tell me what happened. And boys in particular don't like that. So I like to say, hey, come on in, have a snack. Later tonight, maybe at 8 o'clock, can I talk to you about your day? I want to hear how it went. And give him time to process and chill out. And when he knows it's coming, he's much more receptive.
Michelle Eichardt is our guest. She's the creator of Athena's Path, a summer program for girls, and Heroes Pursuit, a summer program for boys. Her new book is called Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Komen Charlotte Race for the Cure, supporting breast cancer education and screenings in the local community, Saturday, October 4th in Marshall Park. Details on corporate sponsorships at KomenCharlotte.org. Well, earlier this week, as you recall, we devoted an hour to fracking, which got a lot of listeners, riled up, as you may imagine. The state is currently in the midst of considering whether or not we'll have fracking, and if we do, what the rules will be that govern it. But there are a lot of people who are really upset by the whole idea of this. They say no matter what we're told, it is bad for the environment. We got a lot of questions from people and a lot of comments from people during our last broadcast this week that we could not get to. So we're going to revisit the topic on Monday with people on both sides of the issue and air your questions and concerns. So join us for that Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The Justice Department opens an investigation into police practices in Ferguson, Missouri. House Republicans outline a legislative agenda for September. And the Labor Department releases the August jobs report.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about middle school kids. I'll bet you there are a lot of people out there who have middle school kids and may have something to add to this conversation or questions to ask about it. You can join us by email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. Michelle Eichard is our guest. Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years is the name of her book. This is the time of life when kids start trying on pieces of adulthood to see what fits and what doesn't. And sometimes they don't always know what fits. And in the process, they are separating themselves from the family and from the parents. And it's difficult for them. It's difficult for the parents. Now, is it snowballing? Is it a snowball thing when they step out and they make these initial forays and they don't fail? Does it encourage them to step further out and spend less time with mom and dad and be further separated from mom and dad?
I'm not sure that it's quite a snowball. I think it's progressive. I don't think that kids get a taste of that success and then say, woohoo, I'm going off on my own. It's more, as we talked about earlier, sort of a – like a – I have a friend who describes this as a – casting a fishing line, and your kid goes out a little bit and they go out too far and you rein them a little bit back in, and then they go a little bit further out and back in. And so it's more of a waxing and waning. Mm-hmm. They'll keep coming back if they feel that you're not judging them on their progress. So the parents who are evaluating their kids' success along the way verbally tend to have kids who feel frustrated that their parents are judging them on all of their mistakes as they go along, and they pull away and talk less to their parents.
And you point out in the book, I think I'm quoting this right or something thereabouts, that as a parent, you should be pleased that your child is making these forays into adulthood and into independence. Because it's a very brave thing to do.
It really is. I say middle school requires bravery for the child and also for the parent. You have to do a lot of letting go. You have to take a lot of risks. And it's hard for parents to appreciate this while their kid is going through it. But the middle school brain goes through some major restructuring. And one of the things that happens is the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that's responsible for impulse control, among lots of other things, really sort of shuts down and takes a break. It's doing a lot of stuff developmentally otherwise, but this aspect of the brain, the impulse control, kind of goes on hold. And the emotional part of the brain takes over, and that's because middle schoolers have to want to take risks. Otherwise, I tell parents, if you want your kid to go to college, if you want them someday to live on their own and not live on your couch for the rest of their life, they have to have some incentive to take risks. And risk feels really good to the middle school brain. The problem is they can't tell the difference between taking a good risk and a bad risk.
Let's talk about the brain here, because this is why kids do stupid things. Kids that have been normal, well-balanced, even-keeled, suddenly start doing stupid things in an adult of a point of view.
Right. Lots of adults agree with that.
And in fact, you have a short quiz in the book about things kids do, like acting like a lawyer, coming to a conclusion first, and then trying to cram a bunch of absurd evidence together to support their theory, deciding that parents don't know very much, doing idiotic things when you know they know better, forgetting homework, where they put their shoes, things like that. This is the prefrontal cortex that you just talked about, this kind of manager of the brain, and you say it takes a long vacation till about age 20, beginning at about age 11.
Yeah, it's doing, like I said, it's doing a lot. It's sort of restructuring and building developmentally. But these really important skills, impulse control, reading facial expressions, critical thinking, all of that goes on pause for a while. Because if your brain were really good at impulse control and thinking critically, the brain of a middle schooler would then say, huh, we have everything we need right here. We have Xbox and a comfy bed and lots of snacks in the pantry. Why would we ever think about going off on our own? And I know it seems early. Like you said, 11 is really, they're not thinking about going off on their own. But developmentally, they really are beginning to build a path towards independence. They're detaching. That's the very beginning part of that process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if impulse control is working, if critical thinking is working really well, that doesn't happen. And I think it helps for parents to understand that, because rather than being frustrated by what's going on, you can say, this is supposed to happen for the end goal to be reached. If I want my child to be a successful adult, if I want them to go to college, if I want them to get a job, if I want them to marry and live outside of this house someday, whatever it is that they hope symbolizes independence, mm-hmm. that has to happen first.
You say that there are two times in life when the brain essentially tosses out everything that it once knew as being right or wrong and good or bad. And it's at age 2 and 11. The temporal lobe purges information it deems unnecessary, and it does so in order to make room for new information. What is so magic about 2 and 11? Why doesn't it happen again at 35?
It's because of the growth. And I often compare middle schoolers to toddlers. They are learning so many new things so quickly. And it's not that that temporal lobe purges everything, but it does an evaluation. And it says, hey, we have to make room for things like algebra, for things like hypothetical thinking. Suddenly, the way that they think about things broadens tremendously. And so it has to decide, I can't keep everything in this file cabinet of my brain. So what will I get rid of? And what it gets rid of is what isn't practiced.
And how much of – well, that's interesting. Because mm-hmm. you do point out that if you want a child to maintain a skill that they've started at 8 or 9, at least make – if they're playing the piano and they hate playing the piano but you want them to play the piano, make them play the piano at least through puberty, because they may stop afterward, but when they come back to it, if they come back to it, they'll still have some of those skills.
It'll kind of be locked in there. I'm sure there are lots of parents out there who have invested in a skill, in an activity. Maybe it's speaking a second language at home. And when that starts to fade prior to age 11, it gets tossed because it hasn't been practiced. Yeah. And I will add that I don't think kids have to do everything all the time. I think there's this trend that kids have to become experts early. We see it in sports. We see it in specializing in an activity early on. And I really don't love that. I'm actually a fan of quitting activities, because I consider middle school to be like a buffet. You should try a lot of stuff and figure out what you like best.
Yes.
So let your kid quit things, absolutely, but not if it's something that you've really invested in and that you know long term will be a benefit to them.
Because you still have to be a parent.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
As these kids begin to detach and begin to make these little forays into the world, and as they learn more, because, you know, middle school, they start feeling like a big kid, not mm-hmm. a little kid anymore. What's the question? Is part of this, because they're learning new information, so they're discarding stuff that no longer seems important, because that was little kid stuff. That was me being in a cocoon. Now I see there's a big world out there. Maybe mommy and daddy weren't right about everything. Is that part of it?
I think that what it boils down to is that they're learning this kind of hypothetical way of thinking. So they're very concrete thinkers when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is equal and everything is black and white to them. And then they get older and they start thinking about things in more abstract ways. And that's exciting. And so that's the part of the quiz that you read about, they become very bad lawyers. It's not that they're thinking, oh, I'm discarding my childhood ways. It's more that they're excited by the idea that they can reach a conclusion and that they might be able to convince people to think their way. Mm-hmm. And so this is how you get kids who say, well, I need that new pair of sunglasses because I always lose cheap sunglasses. And you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And they start cramming more and more absurd evidence into this sort of logical, I'm using air quotes, logical way of thinking that they have, and it really doesn't match up. They're just trying to figure out how to think that way.
So when you have a child and you know you can see it happening, going through these machinations, and you know then that they're not making good decisions, and their critical thinking skills have not developed, you say, if I'm quoting this correctly, that doesn't mean that you, as the parent, should step in and make the decision. Why? Because they have to make mistakes?
Well, just because that part of the brain that does critical thinking, the prefrontal cortex, isn't working very well in that area right now doesn't mean that it doesn't need practice. So again, we don't want that to be purged.
So this is where you talk about becoming an assistant manager.
Exactly, right. I encourage parents to think about the relationship that they have with their middle schooler in the same way that they would think about a boss and an employee. And I know that sounds very unfamiliar, but it works really well. So if you think back to the worst boss you ever had, and I ask parents this, so I have conferences, and I say, tell me, describe your worst boss. And the word that they use most often is micromanage. Mm-hmm. And really, this is what a lot of parents think they need to do when middle school starts. They say, well, if impulse control isn't working well and critical thinking isn't working well, I better micromanage and make sure that everybody stays safe and things get done. When in fact that repels a middle schooler, as it does really anyone. Adults don't like it either. So then I say, think about the best manager you ever had and list some of the qualities that they had. And they'll say things like, they set clear expectations, they were a good communicator, they respected my private life. You know, all of these things that we want parents to do as well. If you go through that exercise and think it through, you'll come up with a pretty good job description for yourself as a parent of a middle schooler. And so I call it being an assistant manager instead of a micromanager.
And in that job as an assistant manager, your job is to help the child think, to slow their thinking down.
That's key. So you're sort of pumping the brakes when they don't have impulse control. You're not slamming the brakes on, but you're slowing them down. And the way that that works is through questioning. So your child may come home and say, someone spread a rumor about me on social media, and they're devastated. And you think, well, here's what you have to do. I'm going to call the principal. I'm going to call the parent of that child. You're going to go into school, and you're going to tell people that it isn't true. And parents start into an action plan. And then the kid doesn't have to think. So instead, you say to your kid, first, you start with empathy. That sounds terrible. That must really feel bad. So you express some empathy first, and then you say, what can you do about it? And you say this without any judgment. You say it very neutrally, and you have a neutral expression on your face.
Yes, don't furrow your brow, you say.
Don't furrow your brow. I call it having a Botox brow.
Mm.
You don't actually have to get Botox. I don't have Botox.
And why not? Why shouldn't you not appear to be? If you're talking about being empathetic,
yep.
When you furrow your brow at somebody else's problems, it seems to be empathetic. So
why not do that? Well, I do that naturally. I think it's a way of expressing concern or empathy or any of those things. Kids actually cannot read facial expressions until they are at least 18 years old. There's this great study out of McLean Hospital, which is one of Harvard's teaching hospitals. And they took adults and they put them through an MRI and showed them facial expressions and said, what is this person feeling? Based solely at looking at their face, what do you think they're feeling? And adults could get it right 100% of the time. And because they were hooked up to an MRI, they saw that adults were using that prefrontal cortex. Then they put teenagers through. Same pictures. They said, what is this person feeling? Teenagers got it right 50% of the time. And because they were hooked up to the MRI, they saw that they were using the amygdala, which is the emotional center of the brain. So when a kid sees a furrowed brow, which you or I think looks kind and empathetic, they see anger. Again, we go
back.
That's
why you also say that a lot of the times they think you're angry when you're talking to them, and you're not.
They do, and parents can always relate to this and sort of laugh about it. You ask your kid, hey, how did your math test go? And they're like, oh, you don't have to get mad at me. And they storm off, and you think, I was just asking a simple question. But they are so sensitive, and they really, it's not their fault. They cannot read your facial expression clearly. Remember that they've been judged thousands of times already at school. They get home, they think you're angry at them, you're judging them, and they shut down.
Is this exacerbated by the fact that a lot of kids spend their life in a phone screen texting? and posting to Twitter and Facebook, where you cannot read the inflection of a comment. You can only read the actual words.
It's interesting. I don't know that it's exacerbated. I wonder if it helps. I wonder if that's part of the reason that kids love texting and social media. I mean, it's...
Because it removes the need.
Yes.
The work.
It's just words saying what words mean. And you don't have this confusion of
simpler.
The face.
It's simpler.
It is, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Okay. So
we're on to something. Let's write a book.
We made a discovery here this morning. So you slow them down. You talk them through things. But if they sometimes react in anger to what they perceive as anger from you, and it's not.
Right.
Because you've asked a question, they say, bah, bah. How do you then talk them down? How do you help them think through and reason through a problem without putting them on the defensive?
Time is your friend. I tell parents to really, you don't have to react right away. When kids are 2 and 3 and 4, you pretty much have to snap to it and answer a question right away or it goes away. You know, when they're in middle school, you've got time. And so I think it's fair to very rationally say to your kid, hey, you seem really upset right now. I'm sorry that you're upset. Why don't you go to your room? And then when you feel better, I'm happy to talk to you about this. I'd love to try to help you work your way through it. And just buy yourself some time. And if you have to get out of the house, go. I also tell parents of middle schoolers, it is time to get a hobby. If you don't have one now, your child is not your hobby. They're not your accessory. Go find something that you love to do that you can throw yourself into because it will help you get through these years at times like this.
This is a time when kids are pulling away because they're trying to explore their world and figure out who the heck they are. But it's also a time when they need to talk about what they're going through to their parents.
Right.
So how do you find that middle ground? Because they need to talk about it, but they don't want to talk about it. They need to hear from you, but you don't know anything. So how do you come to a middle ground on that?
I find, and I've heard from parents all over, that this Botox brow thing, this idea of being unemotional when dealing with middle schoolers is the thing that keeps them coming back to you over and over again. And in fact, I had one parent describe it this way, and I think it's so clever, that middle schoolers are like cats. The less interested you seem in them, the more they want to come around and have your attention. So I try not to be overly invested in my kids' social life, but I'm always there with a neutral expression and a non-judgmental attitude to listen to them. And as I've adopted that, they have become more and more willing to share things with me.
You have, on page 30 of your book, you have a conversation in a situation where a child has made a snap judgment. The son declares he's quitting the basketball team because the coach is a jerk.
Right.
And a father's initial reaction would be, you know, what are you talking about? You can't quit the team. And you're great.
Yes.
What do you suggest a parent – how do you suggest a parent react to something like that?
Again, this idea of being Socratic in your approach, so using questions to engage with kids when they're feeling emotional and upset about something is really effective. Rather than saying, hey, we don't quit things, or you'll be letting your team down, or, oh, honey, I love to watch you play sports. I really wish you'd keep this up.
Kiss of death.
That's the worst. All of those things put a great deal of pressure on the kid. And what the kid really needs to do is slow down, we're pumping the brakes, and think about it. So instead, if a parent were to say, okay, you feel like quitting. I understand that you're really frustrated by this coach. Tell me what you think would happen if you quit. What would that look like? And get the kid to stop and think about it. And you can just continue to ask questions. He may say some things during this process that are really weird. You know?
No.
But you just say, okay, let me hear some more.
How would the other kids feel about this? How would that affect the team?
How would that affect the team? Instead of you saying, boy, that's really going to affect the team. What a bummer. They're not going to go to the championship now. You say, how would this affect them? Get him to think about it. Right. You're doing him a favor.
You're helping them reach the conclusion you would have gotten to anyway. Michelle Eichard's our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Billy Graham Library, presenting author Johnny Erickson Tata Monday, September the 8th, signing copies of her new book about her life as a quadriplegic and transformation through adversity. Details at BillyGrahamLibrary.org. Well, it's Friday. That means the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour first. The Justice Department opens an investigation into police practices in Ferguson, Missouri. House Republicans outline a legislative agenda for September, and the Labor Department releases August jobs report. That's coming up at 10 o'clock, 20 minutes from now, with Tom Jelton sitting in for Diane. With a new school year underway, you're invited to join WFAE to explore the state of public education in the Charlotte region. A panel of educators will share their views and take your questions and comments from the audience during a WFAE public conversation Tuesday evening, September 16th. You can check WFAE.org for details. We're coming right back.
Get up to date on the day's latest news by listening to All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE. It's your front row seat behind the headlines and offers a thorough and accurate account of what happened while you were at work. Make your commute home informative as well as entertaining with the most comprehensive news program on radio today. All Things Considered from NPR and WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Michelle Eichert about her book, Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years, because she didn't have a good middle school experience. She has two kids. One just exited middle school. One is just starting middle school. And she's worked with kids of that age for a decade or more through summer programs called Athena's Path and Hero's Pursuit for Girls and Boys, which have been adopted by school systems around the country. Aaron writes in on Twitter, this is giving me middle school flashbacks, eighth grade, oh so painful. Ben, on our website, Arthur Morgan School in Burnsville, North Carolina, is a middle school designed for middle schoolers. The kids learn consensus decision-making, work on a farm, and experience multiple outdoor trips throughout the year. The students are allowed to be kids and develop very close relationships with each other and their teachers. Are you familiar with this school?
I'm not, but it sounds like heaven.
I love it. Okay, in Burnsville. Bill emails, when I was a gawky kid in 8th and 9th grades, struggling with new schools both years, bullying and 1,000 other issues, my mom was slick in getting me to talk. Quote, I don't have time to fix dessert for supper tonight, but if you could peel some apples, .. She would eventually get conversation out of me with my back to her the whole time. This is just what you were talking about.
And how heartwarming. What a great mom.
As a teacher in CMS grades 8, 9, and 10, just retired after 42 years, the same gimmick work. I can't get all these posters hung. Can you come in for a few minutes during lunch or before school or whenever to help me?
Brilliant.
So to get them to talk.
Yeah. I like it. Keep them busy, keep them active, and no eye contact. It's great.
In addition to believing that parents have to change as their kids enter middle school years, because you say this is a game changer for parents.
Yes.
And it's a game changer because you have to let go, because you have to – why?
Well, it's a game changer because you're not a micromanager any longer.
Okay.
You're not arranging play dates. You're not fixing things. You know, when your kid is little and they have a problem – most parents are in a hurry. So it's like, I'll tie your shoe for you. Let's just get in the car.
Yeah.
Or I'll call that parent and arrange for X, Y, or Z to happen. But that has to stop by the time the kid is in middle school. It's, first of all, it's social suicide to have your parent make the phone call to another parent or to the principal, whatever the case may be. Unless, I will add the caveat, unless there's some severe bullying going on. And that's a repetitive form of bullying, not somebody was a jerk to me one time in the hall. But, you know, parents need to really let their kids solve their own social problems once they're in middle school.
Is that why years ago, if a kid came home with a black eye because he was punched by another kid, dad would say, did you punch him back? Go, you know, punch him back.
That's sort of an old-fashioned notion, I hope. I'm sure it still happens. But I think even that is micromanaging. That's telling the kid what to do, right?
Ah.
And so the difference is moving from, well, punch him right back, to, well, what can you do about it? And asking a question. The thing that happens to kids in middle school when they are teased or humiliated or bullied or whatever it is that they feel powerless and they feel helpless and they give up. And the only way to restore power to someone who feels that way is to let them come up with a solution and handle it. If we don't, we're just sort of enabling that feeling, I can't fix this for myself.
So in addition to believing that parents have to change in these middle school years, you say you have developed several other strong beliefs about these years. Middle school years can and should be fun.
Yes.
For kids and parents. I guess if you follow the rules in the book or the suggestions in the book, you might be able to find your way through that to that place in time. Middle school kids deserve more freedom to explore who they are. Parents should take their child's accomplishments and failures seriously, not personally. Talk about that for a second.
Boy, that's the hardest one for parents. What that means is when your child stumbles in middle school, and there are 1,000 ways that this can happen. It can happen academically. It can happen socially and a myriad of ways in those. Parents tend to take it personally because they have this vision of how they thought their child would grow up and what their child would become. And so they look at it as a reflection both on themselves and also as a sort of a break in the dream that they had. Mm. That's really damaging. It's hard for the parent. It's really especially hard on the kid. So I encourage parents to take problems seriously, treat them with seriousness, but also unemotionally. That's, again, having a neutral face. It's being non-judgmental. It's helping them learn how to process through the problem without solving it for them.
The social world of middle school, you say, is important to a child's development, and that should be treated with respect.
Right.
What does that mean? Does that mean you see, the parent might tend to see their child's problems as trivial?
Absolutely.
But they're not trivial.
They're not. And there was a thing that went around on Facebook. I can't remember how it went. It was one of those graphics that said something about if you don't take the really small things seriously, they won't tell you the really big things. I'm paraphrasing that. But the idea is that if you treat things as being trivial, your kids will stop talking to you about the stuff that really matters. So you treat it all with a certain respect. That doesn't mean don't have a sense of humor about it. My kids and I laugh all the time about what happens in school. But you do have to take the things seriously that they take seriously. That may be One Direction. That may be something you could care less about. But you treat it with respect. It's something that they're passionate about.
Mm. Amanda has a great question. She says, what about explaining the brain changes that the kids are going through to the kids?
Do it. Yes. I love that. A lot of times parents feel like for some reason they have to keep a veil down around all the stuff that's happening. But get the book, open it up, show it to your kids and say, hey, look, this is fascinating. You should understand what's happening with your body. Here's something that's going on. And I have a mother-daughter conference that I do. My next one's in March. I have moms and daughters come together and I explain this to the kids in front of the moms. And I say, moms, you have now gotten demoted. Congratulations. You are now an assistant manager to your child's brain. And kids, you now have an assistant manager. Your job is to tell your mom stuff, and your mom's job is not to overreact. So it works really well to get everybody playing on the same team.
I think this is a repeat email or an addendum to a previous email from Bill. It could be a different person, though. Bill and Davidson. As a teacher, history and English, my subjects are monumentally boring to many eighth graders, especially when taught in traditional ways. But if I made it into a competitive sport or seething controversy, it becomes magical. For example, who found more than 2 dirty jokes in Act 1 of Midsummer Night's Dream?
That's great.
Or let's go outside and simulate Pickett's charge. Or even, can you persuade your classmates that the lead character was acting immorally? Or can you turn this poem into a 3-character play? They will read so carefully to win a contest or an argument. Eighth graders are often bored silly at exactly the time they're starting to be able to tackle serious and complex ideas. The hardest teachers are often the most successful and the most popular, though not usually at first.
I want Bill to be my teacher. I think that sounds incredibly fun and engaging. And I do recall from my own middle school years just what he's saying, that the teachers who I groaned about having at first are the ones I remember with great affection.
Exactly.
They
right.
changed my life.
Yep. And the toughest teacher in high school for me, we all dreaded getting them. And when we got them, we all commiserated, oh, my God, it's going to be horrible. And he would take no nonsense from any of us. And he was demanding, and he was terrific. We loved going to class by the middle of the semester.
And one of the things that I think is missing from our culture these days is a rite of passage for adolescents. And it's sort of a primal need that we have. And I think even these teachers are providing that in a way. You're dreading this. It's going to be hard. I'm going to work you. And when you are done, you're going to feel really accomplished.
Yeah.
You will have survived that rite of passage.
You have.
Yeah. You've earned it.
We've all been through middle school, and so we probably all think we got it down pat. We understand it. Has middle school really changed a lot since most parents were there?
The biggest change by far is the introduction of social media to middle school. I don't think that human nature has changed drastically, but I think that there are tools in place now in our society that change the game. And I happen to have a view on social media that's a little bit different than a lot of parents. I like it.
Mm.
I like it for middle schoolers.
Why?
I think it provides a couple things that middle schoolers really need. It's an outlet for creativity, if used correctly. Now, certainly there are a lot of things that people do on social media that are abhorrent.
Do you monitor your child's use of it? And how do you do that without
I do
being
lightly.
Intrusive?
No, I do lightly. Because I don't think I need to do it any more heavily. But the most important thing that parents can do before they introduce social media to their kid is set up an agreement of understanding that is, I will have access to your social media. I'll look at it. And really the way to explain that is, if you're going to put it out there for the whole world to see, certainly I can see it too, right?
And do kids realize that they're putting it out there for the whole world to see, that there are some things that you can do on social media that can last a very long time with negative consequences?
They realize it theoretically. They realize it academically. Emotionally, it's a different story. And there are a couple reasons for that. One is, when it comes to taking risk, kids care less about long-term effects than what's happening in the here and now. And if something will buy them social credibility with their peers, they overvalue that compared to a risk that it might take. So if you think about it in sort of an old school example, hey, I dare you to jump off that cliff. A kid's going to go, well, I know my leg could get broken, but it would look really cool if it doesn't.
But I remember being told, don't do that because it's going to go on your permanent record.
Right.
Which is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
Ben, but this is a permanent record. This really is
permanent
record.
It is, and it lasts, and parents need to explain that. It's something you have to explain over and over again, and it's part of the monitoring. But there are so many good things to come of it. So creativity is one. And that's like downloading software so that you can, if you're on Instagram, you're making edits. I know so many kids in middle school who have Instagram accounts that aren't even personal. You know, guys are so into shoes in middle school. It's the big thing. So sneaker accounts are all the rage. Sport edits accounts, accounts dedicated to an actress you love or a book you love are great ways to be creative. And the other thing that social media does is it creates an arena for connectivity.
But if there's jeopardy in the halls of middle schools from other kids, isn't there worse jeopardy on Twitter and Facebook?
There is great potential where there is anonymity for kids to be cruel to each other. And it used to be that someone would write an anonymous note about you and stuff it in your locker.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you could...
But only you would see it.
Yeah, and you would throw it away and you'd go home. And now it can follow you around. So,
and it goes to everybody.
Yep. And so breaches of that kind of etiquette, I think, would call for removal from a site.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd say to your kid, hey, if you do something that humiliates another child, then we're pulling you off of this site. But if they're using it well, I think fair enough. They should be allowed
but
to.
But how do you protect yourself from being attacked in those situations or your child being attacked in those situations?
You can't really protect yourself other than to monitor what's going on and if you see it happening to pull yourself off or as a parent to pull your kid off.
What about pornography?
What about it?
It's everywhere.
Yes.
It's easily accessible. And these are kids at an age when they're now curious. How do you approach that?
This to me is one of the scariest things about parenting a middle schooler these days because I hear stories from parents about looking at their internet history at home and being horrified at what they saw and then saying to their kid, why were you Googling this? And the poor child breaks down in tears and said, everybody was talking about it on the bus. I wanted to know what it meant. And suddenly they're seeing videos of some crazy act. And I just think that's heartbreaking to think that kids are exposed to this. The best way that a parent can buffer against that is to talk early to their kids about sex and to be, again, a neutral, non-judgmental source so that if a kid has a question, they will come to you and ask you rather than feeling like they have to go off in secret.
Those conversations historically have been awkward on both sides. The parents don't want to talk about it and the kids don't want to ask about it. But they want to know the answers, but they don't want to ask mom or dad.
It's a little awkward, but it's critical to do.
How do you do it?
Well, you're unemotional about it. You say, hey, you're heading off into middle school. Really, I mean, conversations about sex should start early. Sex experts say as early as 8 years old.
No.
So they have to start really early. But you say to your kid, you know, you're going into middle school. You're going to hear a lot of terms. You're going to hear things that people don't even understand themselves. Come to me and talk to me about it. I'm really okay telling you about it. And use humor wherever you can. I try to laugh about it with my own kids.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's sticky, but you just have to forge ahead.
Lona on Facebook writes, I have a new middle schooler this year. The Botox brow is an aha moment
for
me. That's where you don't show any emotion in your face.
Yes.
Teresa on our website, I'm totally stealing your Botox forehead technique. I have felt this past year I'm doing something incorrectly, but not sure what. I got the empathy down, but I admit to micromanaging. Looking forward to reading your book. The Botox brow, once again, is not furrowing your brow, even though you think it's empathetic. It's being read as angry.
Yes.
Karen emails, please talk about the importance of parents supporting each other. I'm one of the great group of about 8 moms of boys who, drumroll please, just entered college this year. We have a solid support group since 3rd grade. We'll be having our first mom's night out to celebrate our boys next week. We have always had a don't kill the messenger mentality that allowed us to share important information and keep lines of communication open with each other, even when our boys weren't as tight a group as we were. After middle school, they went in different high schools. I don't know what I would have done without my mom's group. They helped me survive middle school.
I love that. And I think we talked about kids being judged as they walk up and down the hallway, but another thing that happens when your kid enters middle school is that you as a parent really get judged. And it's, you know, oh, she let her kid have a cell phone way too early, or oh, she lets her son wear shorts all year long, and I know he's freezing. And that kind of talk really has to stop. I mean, it's nobody's business whether you let your kid have a cell phone or wear shorts all year long, unless you're seeing something really abusive happen. I think parents should be less judgmental towards each other during these years.
Wow. Michelle Eichard's book is called Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. And you have this photograph on the cover of these very pleasant-looking children. They don't look at all like they're going to be attacking me anytime soon.
I hope they don't.
She's also the creator of Athena's Path and Hero's Pursuit. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.